Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Arizona history. Today, I'll begin with an analysis of that famous incident in Tombstone, the gunfight at the OK Corral. We'll look at the characters and the events leading up to that conflict. Before we continue, I want to acknowledge that some of the information that I'm presenting today was compiled and published in two books. The first book is titled Analysis of the Gunfight at the OK Corral by the late Ben T. Trawick, Tombstone's town historian. And the second book is titled The Illustrated Life and Times of Wyatt Earp by Bob Bose Bell, the publisher of True West magazine. The gunfight at the OK Corral lasted 30 seconds, 30 bullets were expended, resulting in 3 deaths and 3 wounded participants. Frank and Tom McLowry and Billy Clanton died from their wounds. Virgil Earp was shot in the calf of his right leg. Doc Holliday was slightly wounded in the hip, and Morgan Earp was wounded in the shoulder. Wyatt Earp was left unscathed, and as a side note, during his lifetime of 80 years, Wyatt Earp was never wounded by a firearm. So let's continue. After the smoke cleared, Sheriff John Behan decided that a crime had been committed, so he confronted Wyatt with an attempt to arrest him. Wyatt's response was, "I will not be arrested. You deceived me, Johnny. You told me they were not armed. I won't be arrested, but I'm here to answer for what I've done. I'm not going to leave town." It's important to review what caused the animosity that resulted in the conflict. There are 11 events that ultimately lit the spark of the gunfight. The first event occurred in late July 1880. Wyatt's brother, Virgil Earp, a deputy U.S. Marshal, was charged by the U.S. Army to assist in locating and recovering 6 mules which had been stolen from Camp Rucker, a military installation 75 miles east of Tombstone. U.S. Marshals are generally responsible for recovering any property that belonged to the federal government. He was to assist Lieutenant J.H. Hurst and join his search party of 4 soldiers. Virgil recruited Wyatt, Morgan Earp, and Wells Fargo agent Marshall Williams. Williams was not an official lawman, but he was responsible for the safety and security of Wells Fargo shipments and passengers. The group rode to the McLaurys' ranch on the Babacomari River. Virgil Earp, as a deputy marshal, held the position of authority. Virgil had done some preliminary investigation and found that the theft had been carried out by the McLaurys, Billy Clanton, and Pony Deal, another known rustler. When the posse arrived at the ranch, they found the mules. The cowboy thieves were in the process of changing the U.S. brand to D8. Not an easy task unless you had lots of experience with this kind of activity. In those days, the term cowboys had a different connotation as it does today. Then, the term referred to organized cattle thieves and rustlers. To avoid a major incident that could erupt into violence, Lieutenant Hurst entered into negotiations with the leader of the cowboy group. The cowboys agreed to return the mules to the posse in Charleston the next day if no arrests were made. Hurst accepted the arrangement, and the posse left the McLaurys Ranch to wait in Charleston. The lieutenant waited for 2 days before the cowboys rode into town and laughed at him, saying that they had offered the compromise only to get clear of the Earp party. Hurst reacted angrily and posted placard notices all over town, accusing each of the cowboys by name. Frank and Tom McLaurys came to town and asked Virgil if he had anything to do with placing the notices. When Virgil said that he did not, Frank threatened Virgil, "If you ever again follow us as close as you did, then you will have to fight." Virgil responded that if ever any warrant for a McLaurys arrest were to be put into his hands, he would catch them. If they were forced to fight, he would not bring them back alive. Later, Virgil said that he was sure that if he had participated in the placement of those accusatory public display notices, that Frank would have tried to kill him on the spot. Of course, the McLaurys never did return the mules. In fact, the mules were never even recovered by the army, and so the animosity between the McLaurys and the Earps began. The second cause of all that animosity was that there was a love triangle between Josephine Marcus, John Behan, and Wyatt Earp. Josephine, the one-time actress who represented herself as Behan's wife, returned from a trip to find Johnny keeping company with a married woman. She did not take kindly to her husband's courting another woman, and she left the sheriff. At some point, some months later, she and Wyatt began a friendship that would eventually grow into a romance. Their relationship became more public, and soon Johnny knew that Josephine, or Sadie, had become Wyatt's girl. Johnny's humiliation turned into quiet resentment. She eventually became Wyatt's life partner. And we'll tell you more about that story later. The third event was the killing of Town Marshal Fred White by Curly Bill Brocious on October 28, 1880. Curly Bill and his cowboy gang were harshly treated that night by Wyatt Earp, and they never forgot it. The gang was soaked with whiskey and started shooting into the sky at the moon and stars for target practice. City Marshal Fred White came to break up the fun and chased one of the cowboys into a vacant lot. The cowboy turned out to be Curly Bill Brocious, one of the leaders of the cowboy troublemakers with a reputation as a dangerous man with a gun. Wyatt had heard the gunshot volley and found the two. As Wyatt approached White and Brocious, he heard Fred White's voice announcing to Brocious, "I am an officer. Give me your pistol." As Curly surrendered his gun, White grabbed the pistol and pulled it forward to yank it out of Curly's hand. It discharged a bullet into White's lower body. City Marshal Fred White died of his wound several hours later. White immediately buffaloed Curly Bill, who fell to the ground. He was arrested with a bloody head wound. After Curly appeared before a justice of the peace for processing, Wyatt rushed him to Tucson before the enraged citizens of Tombstone could gather up into a lynching party. Curly never acknowledged Wyatt's rushing him out of town to prevent his hanging. He eventually was found not guilty, with Wyatt's testimony that the gun went off when Fred White grabbed and yanked it. But the smash of Wyatt's gun over his head never left Curly's memory. Curly traded his gratitude for resentment and added more animosity to fester between the cowboys and the Earps. The fourth cause was politics. Cochise County was to be separated and formed from a portion of Pima County in February 1881. At that time, the general election was a year away, causing all new county positions to be appointed by the territorial government. Wyatt Earp, a Republican, and Johnny Behan, a Democrat, both wanted to become the first Cochise sheriff. White realized that Johnny Behan would probably be appointed due to his numerous political connections and outgoing personality. Wyatt struck a deal with Johnny that if Johnny agrees to appoint White as the deputy sheriff after the appointment, then Wyatt would pull himself out of the running now. Johnny agreed and was indeed appointed as the first sheriff of Cochise County, but reneged on his promise to Wyatt. The deal would have allowed Behan to be the public social glad-handing sheriff, and Wyatt would be the one to do all the dirty work of keeping the peace. Either Johnny did not want to share the prestige of the office with Wyatt, or did not want to share the sheriff's cut of the tax collections, or just did not want to be constantly reminded of his humiliation of losing Josie Marcus. We'll never know. The fifth cause was the attempted stagecoach holdup and murders of Bud Philpott, the driver, and Pete Rohrig, a passenger, near Contention City on the night of March 15, 1881. The Earp brothers captured one of the highwaymen named Luther King and forced him to reveal the names of the others involved. The prisoner was placed in the custody of Sheriff Behan, who promptly and conveniently allowed him to escape. This made Wyatt realize that Sheriff Behan was supporting the cowboy criminals. Wyatt was beginning to realize that it was going to be difficult to bring any major crime perpetrator to justice. The sheriff's department would work against his efforts And if an accused would actually get as far as a trial, there would be several friends and drinking compadres that would falsely testify an alibi for the accused. This had happened quite often when he arrested someone for a crime. It's difficult to find guilt in a person that has several unshaken alibis. This would later have a great impact on Wyatt's action after the gunfight at the OK Corral and the subsequent shooting of Virgil and the murder of Morgan. This realization would force Wyatt to go to the extremes to keep his family from further harm because he had no confidence in the justice system of Tombstone except for his own efforts. The sixth event was an unusual deal that was made between Wyatt and Ike Clanton, Joe Hill, and Frank McLowry. Wells Fargo had offered a $3,600 reward for Crane, Head, and Leonard, the other three involved in the attempted stage holdup. Wyatt wanted to make this arrest because it would likely put him into the sheriff's office the next election, so he proposed a deal with Ike and his lieutenants. The deal was for them to put the three outlaws into a location where Wyatt could capture or kill them. Wyatt would get credit, and Ike, Frank, and Joe would get the $3,600 reward that was being offered by Wells Fargo. Ike thought that Wyatt was quite likely to kill the stage bandits and would not take them into custody, so Ike wanted assurance that the reward would be paid dead or alive. Because of the telegram from Wells Fargo stating that the $3,600 reward would be paid for the outlaws dead or alive, word about the deal became known on the streets of Tombstone. Ike was terrified when he heard of this. He knew well that his outlaw friends, especially the three stage robbers, what they would do to him for double-crossing them. Frantic now, the only way Ike could see himself out of this predicament was to run the Earps out of town or somehow get them killed. Now, at this point, Doc Holliday's sometime girlfriend, Big Nose Kate, complicated the situation even worse. She went on a monumental binge and ended up in the company of Sheriff Behan and County Supervisor Milton Joyce. These two quote-unquote public servants plied Kate with all the drinks she wanted and then talked her into signing an affidavit that implicated Doc in the attempted stage holdup and murders. This would add another wave of panic to Ike. He knew Doc's reputation as a cold killer. The seventh event. In August 1881, a group of about 25 cowboys crossed the Mexican border into the northern Sonora area and gathered up all the loose, roaming stock they could find and brought them back across the border. The Mexicans quickly organized a posse to chase the cowboys to retrieve their cattle and take revenge on all prior border breaches. The father of Billy and Ike Clanton, known as Old Man Clanton, as he referred to by all, was one of those killed at the Guadalupe Canyon massacre. For some reason, many Tombstone citizens and a number of the cowboy gang felt that the Earps and Holliday either were involved or knew a lot more about those dead men than they were saying. One of the people killed by the Mexicans was Crane, one of the fellows that had attempted to rob the stagecoach near Contention City on the night of March 15th, 1881. This was a stagecoach robbery attempt that caused Bud Philpott, the driver, and Peter Roerig, a passenger, to be murdered. This is the incident that caused Wyatt and Ike to strike the deal about. The eighth event was the robbery of the Bisbee stage on September 8, 1881, by Behan's deputy sheriff and livery partner, Frank Stillwell, and Frank's friend, Pete Spence. Frank Stillwell, the cowboy outlaw cattle rustler and future murderer of Morgan Earp, had been appointed by Behan as a deputy. The two culprits, Stillwell and Spence, were arrested by Wyatt, Morgan, Marshall Williams, and Deputy Billy Breckenridge soon after the holdup. The ninth event was when the Clantons and the McLaries began to publicly threaten the lives of the Earps and Holliday in the streets of Tombstone on numerous occasions. In those days of the Wild West, if someone would threaten your life, and it could be shown that the threat was serious, and the person had the capability to carry out the threat, then you could shoot that person and have no fear of prosecution. It would be considered an act of self-defense. White, Earp always avoided a deadly outcome of armed confrontations with his skilled buffaloing method. A slap over the left hand to distract and then draw his weapon and club the aggressor over the head. A very effective method that he learned in his lawman times in Wichita and Dodge City. Of course, in Tombstone, this approach created enemies of permanent members of a community. In Dodge City, he used this method on rowdy drovers who were drunk and were blowing off some steam. Then he dragged them off to spend the night in jail. All would be forgotten when they sobered up, paid their fines, and be on their way heading back home to Texas after they spent all the money earned on the cattle drive. They probably spent several days wondering how they received that bloody bump on their head. The 10th event occurred around noon on October 26, 1881, on the day of the gunfight. Ike Clanton was prowling the streets of Tombstone, armed with a pistol and a rifle, threatening to kill Doc or the Earps on sight. When Virgil found him, he hit him over the head with his pistol and dragged him off to the judge's office on 4th Street, where he was fined and released. The 11th event was when Tom McClary had the bad judgment to challenge Wyatt just outside the justice court. Remembering the incident of the army mules, Tom McClary was blustering over what he would do to Wyatt someday, so Wyatt invited him to make any move he wanted right now. When Tom hesitated, Wyatt slapped him, then buffaloed him with his long-barreled pistol. Another cup of animosity was poured into the barrel. These 11 events provide an explanation for the great animosity that existed between the two groups. Some of this animosity could be construed as personal, but ultimately the Earps had a responsibility to enforce law and had a reputation for being tough and efficient lawmen. The cowboys were professional stagecoach robbers, murderers, and were running a well-organized, wide-ranging cattle rustling ring. There are still some questions we need answers to before we continue to the actual fight so that we can fully understand it. First question is, why did the group of cowboys congregate in the area of the OK Corral armed? There was no prior agreement for the two groups to meet at, to quote-unquote meet at the OK Corral for a gunfight. Well, there seems to have been a separate backstory to the tensions between the two groups. It is theorized that the cowboys were at the OK Corral because the alley at that location borders Fly's boarding house, where Doc Holliday was staying. Ike Clanton was there to assassinate him because they had exchanged many death threats, and he knew that Doc Holliday had a reputation for being an unpredictable, hothead, ruthless killer. Ike brought the cowboys to quote-unquote even the odds, because he did not have the courage to confront Doc alone. Ike and the cowboys were loitering directly below the window of Doc's room, apparently waiting for him. They had not expected the Earps and Doc to appear as a group. The second question is, what prompted the Earps to walk down to the OK Corral? Well, Virgil Earp, whose job it was to enforce the town's policy that prohibited the open carry of firearms, was told by several citizens that the cowboys were armed and were seen hanging around the OK Corral. He was exercising his legal responsibility to disarm the group. Tombstone had that ordinance against the open carry of firearms, and he expected that they would comply with his command to disarm. He hoped that they would be humiliated to the point of stopping their continuous death threats in the future. He did not anticipate the gunfight. Virgil invited Doc Holliday to participate, first because Doc requested to participate. Second, the lawmen did not know how many members were in the group of cowboys, and Virgil felt that additional backup would be useful. It is also speculated that Doc was taking advantage of the opportunity to rid himself of Ike Clanton legally. Bringing Doc was an error in Virgil's judgment, as will be determined later. The third question is, what expectations did they all have of the pending confrontation? When Doc joined the group to confront the cowboys, Virgil handed him a double-barreled shotgun. Doc had a walking stick which he handed to Virgil, who carried it in his right hand, his shooting hand. At the same time, he moved his pistol to his left side, which shows that he did not expect to be shooting. On the walk to the OK Corral, they ran into Johnny Bean, who tried to dissuade them from the confrontation by telling them that he had disarmed the cowboys. Wyatt was holding his pistol in his right hand, and when hearing Johnny's comment, he put his pistol back into his coat pocket, not something he would have done if he had expected their armed resistance. As the leader of the lawmen, should Virgil have anticipated the armed response of the cowboys right from the beginning, at the moment he decided to walk to the area where he heard that the cowboys were loitering? First, the area where the cowboys were congregating was a very small and confining space, a small alley between two buildings. Virgil was the leader of the law enforcement group. He was the most senior and experienced of the team. Considering all the prior animosity that existed between the two groups, it would have been prudent of him to expect that the cowboys would react exactly as they did. After all, they were in a narrow environment and their sworn enemies were asking them to hand over their guns and put themselves at the mercy of the likes of the unstable, murderous Doc Holliday. 2. It was not prudent of Virgil and Wyatt to bring Doc Holliday with a cannon-like weapon, the shotgun, to the fight. Although deputized for the confrontation to disarm the cowboys, Doc was not a law enforcement officer, and his reputation and prior dealings with the cowboys would act like a spark that lights the fuse of a stick of dynamite. And as it turns out, that's exactly what happened. The cowboys reacted to the perceived threat and intent that they would be legally murdered after handing over their defense weapons. 3. The sound of pulling the two hammers back to ready the shotgun to arm Doc's weapon was heard by the cowboys, who then expected to be shot. Wyatt said that he heard the hammers of the pistols being cocked. Many experts later did some sound analysis, and it was determined that Doc's cocking his shotgun is what was heard and is probably the sound that started the cowboys to assume that they were being assassinated by their sworn enemies and felt they had no choice but to pull their own weapons. So Frank and Billy pulled their guns, which prompted Wyatt to fire at Frank. So that begs the question, did Wyatt hear the shotgun being readied for fire? Well, he must have, because that was the only way that Frank and Wyatt would be start shooting simultaneously. Wyatt had his pistol in his pocket, Frank had his in his holster close at hand. How could they begin shooting at the same time? He did not wait until Frank had his pistol drawn and aiming. They both reached for their guns at the sound of Doc's shotgun's hammers cocking. So why did Doc pull back the hammers of the shotgun when the purpose was to disarm the cowboys, not to engage them in a gunfight? Well, remember, there was a backstory to all this. He knew that the cowboys were looking to kill him, and he did not want this to happen in some back alley in the middle of the night. It's possible that Doc wanted this gunfight. He had tuberculosis and knew that he would not live much longer. If he was going to die before he succumbed to his disease, it would have been in some kind of confrontation. Well, as it turned out, he would eventually die in a bed in the sanitarium. It is also important to realize that in the Old West, in any arrest situation between lawman and criminal, even the slightest pushback from the criminal would cause the deputy to shoot. The law was on their side. If the criminal would hesitate or talk back or make the wrong move, they would get shot. The cowboys in the gunfight knew this and reacted immediately upon hearing the noise of the hammers being cocked. So here's another question. What was the general state of law enforcement in the Arizona Territory? Well, first, at the end of the war with Mexico and the subsequent Gadsden Purchase, the United States had increased its territories by more than 500,000 square miles. This includes all of the present-day California, Nevada, and Utah, most of Arizona and western portions of New Mexico and Colorado. John C. Fremont was appointed to govern the Arizona Territory. Fremont felt that his appointment was not satisfactory as a reward for his service to his country, and his disappointment manifested itself in his general neglect of most administrative duties. He spent very little time in the territory, and the secretary of the territory eventually asked him to resume his duties or resign. and he chose resignation. During this time, the two basic industries developed in the Southwest, mining and ranching. Due to the government neglect, the affected area suffered from an epidemic of criminal activities, particularly stage robberies, cattle rustling, and the violence that accompanies these activities. So what else contributed to the general atmosphere of Tombstone? Well, the population of Tombstone consisted of two distinct groups, those that came to get rich quick from the silver mines and then settled somewhere else, and those that came to build ranches, businesses, start families, and settle in for generations. Much of the North and South animosity carried over from the Civil War. Arizona had a history to Southern sympathy and, in fact, had once been declared a territory of the Confederacy. Between the two newspapers and Tombstone, the Epitaph voiced the Republican view, while the slightly older Nugget leaned towards the Democrats. This was a situation filled with a pervasive animosity, with Northerners against Southerners, with miners against town businesses against ranchers, and Republicans against Democrats. Many confrontations and disagreements were fueled with an abundance of alcohol, intense emotions, fake information, greed and self-interest, and fear of loss. By the time of the gunfight, the town was a powder keg. In fact, the town leaders had requested that the government send in armed forces to bring some order to the situation. The government refused. Well, we've reached the end of this broadcast, and I hope you enjoyed listening about the seminal event in Arizona history that actually became a cultural phenomenon for the entire country. I hope you found our stories interesting. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds reader, and we'll have more stories for you the next time we meet. You missed a program, you can get it on demand at the Sun Sounds website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Scroll down to the programming links and choose On Demand Broadcasts. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device.